The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Now we step into diabetes anew. Welcome Dr. Daniel and his guests to Freedom 106.5 FM.
Good afternoon to all listeners. And yes, we do have a very special guest today with us. But of course, before I begin, I want to start by telling our listeners what's going on at the association. But I also want to wish all of the nurses out there a very happy Nurses Week. This past, I believe it was Monday, or the day before was Nursing Day. Want to pay homage to the nurses and of course, show our appreciation on behalf of the association for all of the good work that they do, all of the support that they do, or they give to patients living with diabetes. So I want to send out a very special good day to all of the nurses out there who may be listening and supporting and part of the Diabetes Association as well, because we do have quite a lot of nurses who are part of the association as members and as even part of the executive. So we're looking for to get more nurses involved in the organization as well. I want to tell our listeners, of course, we have a lot of things happening at the association. Particularly right now, we're running a few research projects. And if you are interested in taking part in any of these research projects, you could reach out to the association. We're doing a frailty and diabetes project right now. So if you're between the ages of 55 to 75, we're doing an assessment of frailty and diabetes. And you could reach out to us at the association and become a participant. And of course, you'll be able to get access to all of the tests that we do on you. You'll be able to get access to those results and, of course, assist us in looking at what's happening with frailty. And I think one of the shows we're going to do very soon, we're going to be chatting about what is frailty and how frailty is related to diabetes, actually. We do have our sixth form internship program coming up. So we have about a month again for you to apply. If you are a sixth former or you know a sixth former, whether you're in lower sixth or upper sixth and you have interest in going to the health field or you want to become part of the NGO, then you could sign up. Of course, it's very competitive. So we ask the young people to write some essays for us, and then we'll be able to choose the top candidates for that sixth form program. And then we have lots of other activities happening. We have our eye screening. We have our testing at the head office. So you can reach out to the association. A reminder, if you want to reach the Diabetes Association, you could give us a call at 607-3288. So that's 607 dot. Or you could give us a, or send us a message on Instagram, on Facebook, on TikTok, on LinkedIn, any of those platforms that you're on. So you could reach us like that. But I want to go into our program because it is a program that I think is going to be very much important, and it might be able to save someone's life one day. We have Dr. Nicholas Mirage with us, and he has been on the program before when we chatted about neuropathy. And he's a neurologist, and he is also the director of the Synapse Medical Services Center. He's going to tell us a little bit about himself, but before we go on, we're going to talk about stroke today. Because, of course, many people with diabetes are sometimes afflicted with stroke, and we don't know what it is, and many persons don't know what to do when it actually happens. So on today's program, we're going to be focusing on stroke. We're going to be taking your calls. We're going to be taking your questions. So if you do have a question for either myself or Dr. Mirage, then you could send us a message. I know we're going to have Beach joining us soon, and we'll be able to take some messages on some calls. But I want to start the program by asking Dr. Mirage to introduce himself, because I want our listeners to hear from him, and I wanted to tell us a little bit about your journey towards becoming a neurologist, Dr. Mirage.
Andrew, thank you so very much for the opportunity to be here. I've known you for a bit over 2 years now when I started working with the Diabetes Association, and it's been a very encouraging and a very seamless experience so far. What you guys do there, your organizational structure, your leadership ability, and all the things that you've put in over the last period of time, I've seen it grow, and it makes me very, it fills my heart with a bit of joy to know that we have such a good standing association for the most troublesome lifestyle disease in our population. It really will make a dent in the future regarding both the physical complications, economic complications due to diabetes and only the emotional trauma that it causes his families and patients in the long run. So just wanted to say thank you very much for all the good hard work you guys are doing there at Diabetes Association. How did I start ending up? How did I end up where I am? I really liked, so in secondary school, I wanted to be a doctor. One of my doctors had ended up saving me when I was pretty young. I had a pretty bad allergic reaction, and I thought that the ability for somebody to provide such care for somebody else was an amazing thing. So I wanted to be able to give that back to people at some point in time. Went to secondary school, ended up getting into med school here in UE, and during that period of time, I really latched on to neurology, because it was this deep-seated interest in the brain, because it's kind of govern everything you do, from your movements to your memory, your emotions, your speech, and your thinking. So this was really, really fascinating to me. And through med school, you needed a lot of detective work to be able to do it. You needed to be a little bit smart because it's very, very complicated. When I started doing it in as a doctor, I realized how much more compassion you needed to have being able to do it, because so many patients come to you in such vulnerable states because the brain is important in controlling all of these functions. They become very, very no longer independent, and a lot of their dependence on certain other people, and they turn to you for guidance and help through that. And when I finished training here as an internal medicine specialist, I went up to Canada and I did my general neurology fellowship, and then I did stroke neurology because stroke was the biggest part of neurology. One in four people in the world is going to have a stroke at some point in time, so it's the biggest opportunity to make some sort of impact. And the greatest thing with stroke is that over the last 20 years, the treatment has gotten better. So rather than 20 years ago, somebody got a stroke and we just kind of left them alone, and they got rehab, and maybe they got better, maybe they didn't get better. We've gotten so much better treatments in the last couple of years to get patients from being that disabled anymore to trying to overcome that. That was where I decided to put all my time and research efforts into, and been back here since 2018 trying to put a dent into the scourge, stroke and neurology problems we have. So yeah, in a nutshell, sorry about that. I felt rambling.
Definitely, it's appreciated, and I think that you giving that story of being touched by a physician, saving your life, inspiring you to become a doctor is so important. I think many of our young people, and that's why we do the sixth form program, for example, because many of our young people want an avenue to be able to learn more and be guided. And I would say, for example, our sixth form program, we've started about 4 years. Many of the students are in med school now. And the aim of doing it and doing that program is really to foster those future leaders, because it is my hope that one day all of these young people that we would have taken in would be doctors or nurses or whatever. I would come back to the association and support the association. So it's very, again, noble of well, we hope that nobility will be there, but of course we see that in you, because although the association hasn't touched you there, you are working and you're supporting us, and we're hoping that other physicians and other healthcare professionals come on board as well and do that work. So I know that may have inspired some persons listening out there to go into medicine or maybe go into neurology at one point in time. But let's get into the topic of stroke, because most persons would have heard the term stroke before and not sure what it is. So I wanted to explain to our listeners what is stroke and what are the different types of stroke that someone could have.
Fantastic. So when we think about a heart attack, we think about a clogged artery or damage to a part of the heart that prevents the heart from working. The other word that we use for stroke is a brain attack. It doesn't really caught on that much, but it's a way that I use it to try to describe to patients what's happening. Different parts of your brain are responsible for different parts and different things. The right side of your brain is responsible for the left side of your body, left side of your brain for the right side of your body. The back area is responsible for vision, the front right area is responsible for speech, left front area a little bit for more speech, and different areas do different things. And all of these areas are supplied by pipes that carry blood to them to get food and oxygen and take away the bad things that the cells use and get rid of. So it takes away the carbon dioxide and all the waste products of the metabolism that the cells do to make sure that the brain is working functionally. What happens in a stroke is that one of the pipes leading to a specific area of the brain becomes either dysfunctional. So there are two types of strokes. There's blockages or there's ruptures. So the blockage in the brain strokes are called the ischemic strokes or the clot in the brain strokes. And those are about maybe four out of five strokes that would happen to any person, that's about 80%. And then there's the bleeding in the brain strokes or the hemorrhagic strokes. And that's maybe about 20% of all the strokes. When there's a blockage, that blockage prevents blood from reaching that particular area of the brain that's supplied by that pipe. And that area, the cells don't work functionally. Then you will start to get weakness, trouble speaking, trouble with memory. If it happens for a prolonged enough period of time, those cells might die and the patient would have a established stroke. If it happens for a very short amount of time and that clot naturally busts itself up and goes away, the person would said to have had something called a TIA or a transient ischemic attack or a mini stroke, as we call it nowadays, and the person will get better. And this is the type of person you want to help the most because they're at risk for further stroke and they've gotten better on their own. In the bleeding in the brain stroke, the 20%, that's due to a rupture in the brain and due to a rupture of one of the blood vessels. So that pipe isn't working the way it is anymore. So that area of the brain doesn't get the blood that it needs. And this person would need to be treated in another specific type of fashion.
So when we think of all of these, the two main types of stroke you would have mentioned, and even with a TIA, what are the risk factors? Because we often tell people, of course, that many persons listening to the program would know about the risk factors for diabetes, for example. What puts someone at risk for having stroke or getting a stroke? What is the correct verbiage I need to use? Is it getting a stroke, having a stroke? What should I say first of all?
You can really use either of those because a stroke is something that happens to somebody. So you can get a stroke or you can have a stroke. So risk factors, we try to break down risk factors into either modifiable and non-modifiable. So modifiable means things that you can change, and non-modifiable risk factors means things you can't change. So the non-modifiable risk factors are very small. They're age. And there's gender or sex, depending on what type of nomenclature you want to use for that. So males are a bit more higher risk than females in terms of getting strokes. And as you go up in age, your risk of getting a stroke increases. And you can't stop yourself from getting older, and you can either be genetically a male or genetically a female. So those inherent risks are non-modifiable risk factors, but the things that we can adjust are the modifiable ones. And the big ones are high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking, heart disease, lifestyle things such as a very sedentary lifestyle, chronic stress, and uncontrolled alcohol consumption is also a big risk factor, as well as something called sleep apnea. So those are the big modifiable risk factors. Going over them again, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking, heart disease, chronic stress, uncontrolled alcohol consumption, and sleep apnea.
And those, of course, are shared risk factors with diabetes and other heart diseases and so on. So confirm for me all of the older, maybe older folks that might believe if you're in the hot sun and they go in the refrigerator after, you're not going to get stroke, right?
No, that is definitely not how you catch a stroke. You don't go from the hot into the cool and you catch a stroke.
So I know many people still believe that, but I mean these are the risk factors. So again, being overall healthy and but I would say I know you would have mentioned the non-modifiable risk factors in terms of men. Now, I always look at that as maybe it has a physiological or genetic influence, as in men just naturally have a higher risk of stroke. Or is it rather cultural in that? Is it because that men don't tend to, not to take care of themselves as well or attend to issues as quickly as women? What do you think? Why do you think men have a higher risk?
That's a very valid point that you raised there. And it's very difficult to tease out those things. But you do, it's very correct that men culturally don't like to go to the doctor, don't like to seek any sort of help for their ailments, don't like to become or even admit to themselves that they're becoming unwell, and just continue to promulgate this very bad or unhealthy types of lifestyles will eventually progress to damage the pipes inside of the body, which one, contribute to stroke, two, contribute to heart disease, three, contribute to kidney trouble, and all of these diseases, these lifestyle diseases are connected, as you exactly said. And if you attend to the lifestyle risk factors, you significantly decrease your risk of something significantly serious happening to you.
And definitely we need to learn more about stroke. I mean, for men and women, and we'll talk shortly about how do you identify stroke. And I'm particularly curious about if there's a difference in men and women, because I've heard that it's identified differently sometimes in men and women. But I know we should take a break. So I think Beast is in studio with us, so we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll also take your phone calls, we'll take your messages. We're also live on Facebook on the Diabetes Association page. So you could send a message underneath the live, and we'll also take those questions. So, Beast, let's go to break with Dr. Nicholas Mirage talking about stroke. Let's go to break.
And now we return to Diabetes and You on Freedom 106.5 FM.
And thanks, Tosca. I'm glad you are here with us this afternoon.
Not a problem.
But you'll let us know if we're getting any phone calls or if
Sure.
we do have some messages.
Yes, I will.
And of course, I'll remind all listeners, viewers on Facebook, that they could also send us a message as well. So we're here with Dr. Nicholas Mirage, and we're talking about stroke. We were chatting earlier before the break about what are the risk factors of stroke. But I really want persons to listen to this because we need to know how to attend to stroke. So I want you to tell us, what are the signs of stroke? What are the signs that someone is having or have had a stroke recently?
The big things is that it there's an there's a little bit of a word, a couple of letters that I tell patients. This is the easiest thing to remember. It's called be fast, BEFAST. So you want to be fast if somebody's having a stroke. The B stands for balance. So if somebody suddenly has a change in their balance or coordination, for example, they're uncoordinated with using one hand, or they're drifting to one side, and it's a sudden change. E stands for their eyes. If they have any sudden change in their vision, so like sudden blind, double vision, or trouble seeing out of one eye, that's BEF. F stands for face. So if the patient has facial weakness or facial drooping on one side, you tell the person, hey, can you smile or grin your teeth? And if like one side of the face alone is moving and the other side isn't moving or isn't moving as well as the other side, you want to pay attention to that. A stands for arms. So if one hand is weaker than the other arm, I tell patients to try and tell their family members, put both hands out in front of them like they're trying to carry a tray. And if one side is staying up and the other side isn't raising up at all or can't raise up as strongly as the other side, that's something to be concerned about. So that's balance, eyes, face, arm. S stands for speech. If the person has any sort of slurred speech or difficulty speaking that happens all of a sudden, that's important. So you ask them to say their name or say where they live or what they had to eat today. And if you find their speech is garbled or they can't understand, that's a bit of a troubling sign. If you have any of these things, balance, eye trouble, facial weakness, arm trouble, speaking trouble, it's T, time to call emergency services, which is 811 in Trinidad. Be fast, get somebody to the emergency health services as soon as possible, because time is brain to try and save somebody when they're having a stroke.
So that acronym would help people understand or be able to identify if themselves or a family member is having a stroke. What does it feel like? Because besides having these symptoms, does the person feel pain at that point in time? Is it like a heart attack? You'll feel the pain. What would a person feel like when they're having a stroke?
More than likely, patients don't get any pain. In a very small population of patients, the stroke can be due to, you can feel some sort of headache type of thing in the area of the brain that's responsible for the stroke. But more than likely, patients don't feel pain at all. It's usually a sudden, very, very quick in onset change in your normal functioning. You know that, oh my God, oh, something's off, I'm off balance, or my vision, I can't see good, or hey, most patients, they face not working so well. Usually somebody else tells them that, but you notice that their hand feels heavy, weak, they can't lift it up, or they start speaking out, I can't talk, what's this? They don't get pain, but they get this sudden onset of change in their normal neurological functioning.
That'd be amazing. So I have a question from one of our listeners about taking aspirin when they detect that someone has a stroke. What is your thoughts on that?
That is a very good question. And lots of people ask me that maybe at least once every 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
So based on the types of strokes, 4 out of every 5 strokes are clot in the brain strokes, and 1 out of every 5 strokes are bleeding in the brain strokes. So 80% of the time, if you give somebody the aspirin, they quote unquote would be okay and you'd be doing them the right thing, but 1 out of 5 times they'd be having a bleeding in the brain stroke and you would most likely end up killing that person. So I'm not a good gambler, and I don't think somebody who is non-medical should be potentially trying to treat somebody who's having a stroke to the emergency services as soon as possible, particularly a hospital that can do CT scan of their brain. That's the most important thing, because we need to take a look inside of the brain to determine if it's a clot in the brain stroke or bleeding in the brain stroke, and then decide how to act accordingly.
So I have a question for you about this, because it may be a little controversial. You detect that someone is having a stroke and you call the ambulance, but they're living in a very rural area.
Right.
Do you make the decision to wait for the ambulance that might take a half an hour to an hour, or get the person in a vehicle and take them to the hospital? What is your opinion? What should be done in this circumstance?
In ideal situations, the ambulance arrives precisely in time and gets the person to the appropriate emergency services. If you are inordinately waiting long for your family member to get some sort of treatment when you suspect they have a stroke, it's imperative that you try to get them to an emergency service as quickly as possible, because the more time that you spend with the person having the stroke, it's the more of the brain that's going to become non-functional, and the greater the risk that they're going to have enduring damage, because you might miss the window within which treatment can be effectively done.
So is it that we're not doing any damage to them further if we decide to take them with our own vehicle? Or is it that we should keep them in place when they are having a stroke? And if they're having stroke, should we have them lie down? Should we have them stay seated? What should we do? You have a family member that you're seeing these symptoms, they call the emergency room. What should you do? Well, they call the ambulance. What should you do in the meantime while the ambulance is coming?
Definitely you put the person to lie down, and you typically want to put them to lie down on one side so that they don't have any sort of the risk of aspirating contents of food or anything into their lungs decreases, and you keep them lying down because that increases blood flow to the brain.
So we have the person at the emergency room now. So they come into and they come to see you, or the ambulance brings them into the room. What happens? So walk us through the procedure. Walk us through what happens when someone comes into the emergency room when they do have a stroke.
Important thing is that the triage people identifies that this person is having a suspected stroke, and the different scoring criteria that we use those to determine if it's a mild stroke, moderate, or major stroke. And then you get your vital signs done quickly to know what's your blood pressure, to know what's your blood sugar, because low blood sugar can sometimes mimic a stroke, and then you could rule out that as a cause. You get the blood pressure to see what the patient's blood pressure is like. They do a quick physical examination of the patient to determine what's going on with their heart rhythm, to see if that they have an irregular heart rhythm. And we do something called the NIHSS, the National Institute of Health Stroke Severity Score, to determine quickly, within less than a minute, how bad this person's stroke potentially is. And we try to rush them to do a CT scan of the brain as quickly as possible to determine what type of stroke they're having.
And so what would the treatment then look like? So as soon as they get into the hospital, you've taken the CT scan, you've confirmed that they've indeed had a stroke. What does the treatment start to look like? Is it something administered immediately? Is it something that's going to be administered over a period of time? Tell us about that.
Good. So we have this magic window period right now of 4.5 hours from the beginning of somebody having a stroke to being able to give them this magical medical therapy called a clot busting medication that works, that you inject it into the veins, it goes up to the clot, and it bursts up that clot up there, allowing the blood flow to reestablish itself. The quicker you get it from the time that the stroke has happened, the more likely and more effective the medication is, because it helps save more of the brain that was at risk and keeps a lot of the other brain that's not been affected from becoming affected. 4.5 hours is the current American Heart Association, American Stroke Association guidelines regarding the time period to give this clot busting medication. However, new studies are being done all the time to determine increased time window and certain other types of medications that can be used. So and let's like when I used to practice in Canada, we put patients, depending on the type of stroke they were having, they used to either get something called one of the clot busters is something called altipase, and there's another one called tenecteplase. Some patients used to get altipase, some patients used to get tenecteplase, and different people would respond differently to those two medications. Now certain parts in the world have authorized tenecteplase to also be used in addition to altipase. So that's a good thing. That's a good indication that the scope of treatment for stroke is getting more accessible to people, and the ability that for us to understand what happens within the brain for stroke gets better. Now, there are certain patients who that clot busting medication does not work, where you can actually put a wire into their circulation, sneak it all the way up into the brain, into the clot that's there, and try to pull the clot out. And that's mechanically trying to unblock that pipe that's blocked. That's called mechanical thrombectomy. It isn't available in all facilities in Trinidad, but it is one of the more one of the it, that time period is a bit longer. The American Heart Association, American Stroke Association says up to 6 hours, and in certain special populations, you can extend it all the way up to 24 hours.
So again, your reminder to the listeners is fast, right? So you need to get to the emergency fast to be able to get this treatment.
Gotta be fast.
Be fast.
BEFAST. Gotta be fast.
Be fast. And 4.5 hours again, is that magical time. So if it is that someone then doesn't get to the emergency room in that time, say they get to the emergency room 8 hours after for some reason because they didn't know what really happened to them or that they needed to get there quickly. What then is going to happen?
So it depends on which type of stroke they have. If they have a clot in the brain stroke or bleeding in the brain stroke. The bleeding in the brain strokes, you control the blood pressure to try and to stop the bleeding, to prevent the damage from happening. With regard to the clot in the brain stroke, those areas would have already become potentially irreversibly damaged. So you give them blood thinners. Like this is where the aspirin comes into play. Aspirin is a blood thinner. We give them that to try and prevent the risk of another stroke happening to them. That's called secondary prevention in this situation.
So we often see, of course, people with stroke and they're sometimes paralyzed at one point or one half of their body, and you mentioned that before. But if it is that someone does receive this treatment within the 4.5 hour window, does that mean that all of the paralysis that is often accompanied by what we think stroke is doesn't happen to the person, or is it happen at a lower extent? What is the outcome for patients who are actually treated fast versus the outcome for patients who have delayed treatment and they have parts of the brain not able to function anymore?
That's a very complicated answer because certain patients are very quick progressors for some strange reason. So, for example, their brain anatomy has maybe one pipe alone supplying that one area versus maybe a couple other patients who might have a little bit more pipe supplying that one area of the brain. And they can withstand a longer duration of time before their brain becomes dysfunctional. And some patients don't have that endurance or wherewithal. So it does vary from person to person. The ideal situation is to get the patient the studies have been shown that when you give the medication, you reassess them at a 3 month or a 90-day marker. And with the medication, you found that more patients progress to having functional independence, that is an ability to walk independently without an aid at that 90-day mark, who've received these treatments within the stipulated time frame.
So is it that someone who would have received the clot busting medication, whether it is that they received it and it worked really well for them or not, are there other medications besides aspirin that are taken? Because I tell you this, I know of people thinking or people going to stroke doctors and having to get this cocktail of medication. So I don't know whether, tell us, whether does that work, does that not work? What is this thing that they're injecting into them? And is it advised?
That has been a bit of a pet peeve for me since I come here. There is no studies in the medical literature regarding any of those types of treatments increasing patients getting better. From what I understand, it's a combination of like B vitamins, steroids, and maybe some normal saline, which is regular salt water that patients get injected into them. These things, when your brain is damaged, your brain swells, and steroids generally help with brain swelling. But that swelling naturally gets better on its own. So more than likely, the patient would have gotten better without this sort of medication or this injection in the first place. Steroids also have increased risk of problems, particularly causing gastrointestinal bleeding. Now, I've seen quite a number of patients go for these treatments and come back with gastrointestinal bleeding because now they're on steroids and they're on blood thinners, and now they're bleeding, and now you can't even give the person their blood thinners that they're supposed to get anymore. So you end up in this really bad conundrum, and you don't know what to do anymore. A lot of patients end up going for these things because they just want to get better. And I understand the want to try every single thing to try to get you better from a patient perspective kind of view, but it shouldn't be that they're getting treatments that aren't shown to help them.
And they're pretty expensive, eh? I know that some of them are $1,000 for an injection or more, and they go every week. And I know of particular areas where you have these people lining up outside to get this thing.
Early
So,
hours in the morning.
So is it that the medical board needs to intervene here, or what do you think needs to happen? Because I mean, I'm advocate for when people are fooled by things in Trinidad, because of course you waste your money, but of course you waste your time and all, and you get sicker than you were before. So what do you think we need to do about this?
Most important thing we need to do is to continue educating the population about the lack of robust evidence that these things work. Then I believe, well, I've approached some of the people in authority to try and get this a bit rectified. It's in you know how long these things take, so hopefully things get some sort of answers to them.
Well, I hope so as well, because I mean, This is a very vulnerable population, and again, they're trying to try anything possible to get some relief. But I want us to talk a little bit about what actually can be done. So you have someone with paralysis. What actually does have evidence to support it, in terms of assisting these persons? Is it physiotherapy we need to do for these persons? Is it taking aspirin to prevent another stroke? What do you do with someone who already has paralysis due to stroke, and what do you do?
Fantastic. So somebody who has a bit of trouble already, with somebody who suffered a stroke and has been better, you have a bit of a multifaceted approach. One, you want to try and prevent a second stroke. So you want to identify where the stroke came from in the first place. So you need to have a look at the pipes carrying blood up to the brain. You need to have a look at the heart with an ultrasound of the heart and a 24-hour ECG monitor to look for irregular heart rhythms, which would have caused that stroke in the first place. Get those things done. And depending on what the risk is, you will be on some sort of blood thinning medication, whether it's aspirin alone, aspirin and Plavix, Plavix alone, or some other anticoagulant if you have irregular heart rhythm. You address the other risk factors that would have increased your stroke risk, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking, and you get the appropriate counseling and medical treatment for those. Regarding functional rehabilitation and mobility, it's speech therapy if the person has trouble speaking. It's physical therapy if the person is paralyzed or weak, enduring after, if it's upper limb or their lower limb giving trouble. And then there's also occupational therapy that's important for patients who have a little milder strokes but can't do the things that they were previously able to do, like type if they're going back to work, or draw in the cases of patients who need to sign their names and whatnot. And one of the big things that we don't address is patients' emotional health and mental health after this. So patients need a lot of counseling, because you can imagine emotions that you go through. You're independent, up and about, taking care of your family one day, and then suddenly you're paralyzed. I mean, that transition is ridiculous for some patients, so they need to manage that. So we refer them to the appropriate mental health advocacy people to try and help them with that.
Well, that support is definitely needed, and I think we need to discuss some more about if in fact that type of support is available at the extent that it's needed, because I've heard many persons say that they need this help, but they aren't able to access this type of help. But I've asked a lot of questions, and I know our listeners may have questions as well. I want Oscar to share our phone numbers and WhatsApp numbers, and we'll take some calls, we'll take some questions as well.
The numbers are 625-2257, 627-3223, and of course 306-1065. One question coming in here says, what is Dr. Maraj's view on controlling an acutely high blood pressure during the stroke, or is cerebral blood flow regulation allows for the high BP? Please also explain that the clot buster does have potential significant risks.
Let's see. Controlling the blood pressure. It depends on what type of stroke. So if it's a bleeding in the brain stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke, you want to acutely drop the blood pressure to prevent further bleeding. And in the setting of somebody who has an acute clot in the brain stroke, it depends on if they've gotten clot-busting medication or not. If they've gotten clot-busting medication, you need to control the blood pressure and bring it down to reduce the risk of secondary bleeding into that area of the brain. And if they've not gotten that clot buster, there are guidelines that indicate how long you allow the brain to auto-regulate and increase the blood pressure to allow that area of the brain to be satisfied with blood, or at least the areas that are still at risk to get enough blood, so that you don't get a secondary stroke on top of that from unnecessarily bringing the blood pressure down too quickly. That's a very, very medically oriented question. And I know it's some sort of one of my students or somebody that asked for that, definitely. The other question is regarding the clot-busting drug side effects. The two biggest side effects, one, this is a clot-busting medication, so the risk of bleeding is there. With ALTPAs or TPA, the risk is about 6%. So 6 in every 100 people who get the medication will have some sort of bleeding in their brain or in some part of their gastrointestinal tract or somewhere in their body. And the patients who get tenecteplase, they have a little bit less than 6% bleeding. So that's the biggest two side effects or potential complications of giving the clot busting medication. Good question.
Okay.
Really good question.
Yeah, definitely good question. It really sounds like someone informed asked that question. I have a question from.
I'm sorry, but the response to that was I did not want the public to think that clot busters are risk-free. We've got a call coming in. Let's take this one. Hello. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Yes, you're live. Good afternoon.
Hi, doctor. Good day. I am living with diabetes, high blood pressure, you name it. I'm a walking bomber. It's very scary. I get a lot of cramps. My God, and what helps? I don't know if it is medical thing, but I soak some salt and I drink some of my herbs and water, and I walk and I stump and I cry and then I get relief. But whenever the salt is bad, you know. Or what else can I do? But I cramp a lot. I don't know if it's the diabetes or what causes it. But I have a lot of veins too on my foot. I mean, it's not bad, but it's way up, but it's very cold. And it's so nice to hear you all speaking about it, you know. And I had a stroke already, but I didn't know I had a stroke. I just feel this numbness coming up in my arm, and my daughter was there, and she said, "Mommy, let's go to the hospital one time." And when they do all the diagnosis and whatever machines, and they said, "Do you know you had a stroke?" I said, "Oh my God!" But things were dropping out my hand, eh? And so I guess that is one of the symptoms, and I didn't know. So I'm living in a kind of walking time bomb.
Thank you so much for your call. 625-2257, 627-3223. Any responses to that?
So I think Dr. Murad, she asked about cramping. That's what I think I got from her.
So I didn't really hear the story there too well. So if it's so cramping could have multiple different causes. If it's cramping in your legs only, that is a possibility that that's diabetic neuropathy, or it could be some sort of other neuropathy from, like maybe degenerative spinal disc disease. If it's cramping in the part of the body that's had the stroke, it could be due to excess muscular activity in that area and maybe needs a bit of stretching and whatnot. But I'd need to know the person's a bit more in-depth understanding about the person's medical story to make a better, more informed assessment. That just because I didn't really hear everything so well.
I didn't hear the first part as well either, but I think the second part she would have mentioned that she did have a stroke, and then of course I'm not sure how it is now, but I think she said she walks and so I'm not sure what happens, but do you then get pain after you have a stroke? Like is the num is the paralysis accompanied by pain?
It depends on the type of stroke that you have. So if you have a stroke in a particular part of the thalamus, you can have a thalamic pain syndrome on one half of your body or specific areas only. And it's a kind of burning, shocking, current nerve pain type of thing. If you've had a stroke with weakness in one part of your body due to muscle atrophy or the muscles degenerating because they're not supplied by the brain signals anymore, the muscles can become a bit weak and a bit stretched, and they can feel tighter. They can become spastic. So you can feel some level of pain depending on what's the underlying cause.
So I know we just have a few minutes left.
We have a phone call.
Best any call.
Hello, good day.
Hello?
Yes, you're live on Freedom.
Yeah, it's me again. I didn't expect you to cut me off. I don't know why.
Apologies. I didn't know that I did cut you off, but
Yeah,
you
I
can
can stay
give
on the
some more
line.
details to the doctor.
Yeah, I can stay on the line. Yes. Go ahead, doctor. Hello?
Doctor, yes, she's waiting on a response from you. So they're waiting for you to give more details on your...
Like what do you want to know, please?
Pardon?
She would like to know what you would like to know from her condition so that you can give her a little more advice.
It would be a lot of personal medical information that I wouldn't want to share over the radio waves there.
Oh, but I don't have any pains. I heard you asking if you have pains. No, I'm back to normal. I'm doing all my housework and, you know, but there's always that fear and you're living in a time bomb, you know.
What you definitely need to do is make sure your diabetes is well controlled, make sure your blood pressure is well controlled, make sure your cholesterol is good, and whichever medications your doctors have you on, you keep taking them. Get regular exercise as much as you can, keep yourself well hydrated, and make sure and keep your doctor's appointments.
Yes, so that I am in the clinic.
Good. So you seem like you have the right set of things in order to try and manage you as best as possible to try and prevent one of these things from happening again to you there.
Edward, in the clinic, they try to dish you out quickly, you know, because the amount of patients there are, you know.
All right, so the doctor's advice is to continue to go into the clinic and any other changes within your health to let them know as soon as possible. Thanks so much for calling.
And thank you for having this program.
Okay.
Very nice.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All the best.
625-2257, 627-3223, and a message coming in from 3061065. Good afternoon. In light of the high rise in strokes, would it be possible when opening the health centers in remote areas 24 hours to have this medication? Because the time it takes to reach the general hospital, it's too late.
Good question. So what we would need to, the most important thing you need to have is you need to be able to get a CT scan. So as there's many different, so stroke logistics is a whole subspecialty of stroke itself to identify where you put very scarce resources to maximize the gains for the specific patient populations you have. So depending on the time period it takes for a person to get from point A to point B, it might be necessary to have a sit open a bit longer, especially if they have CT scanning facilities to identify what type of stroke somebody has and then be able to administer that medication appropriately. The timing really, as you say, is the issue, but we have a bit of a scarce resource in terms of accessibility, how many scans we're going to put in different places, in different areas. So we try to do studies to determine what would be the best way to treat the most number of people while trying to understand the other things that we need to put those resources into. For example, like Andrew would be a proponent for as much diabetes care as possible. And the more we can control those underlying risk factors, the more likely we are to control these secondary things that happen, like stroke, heart disease, kidney failure, eye disease. Yeah. So lifestyle disease is really important to get those things under control.
Definitely. And I mean, the focus needs to be a lot in primary care, as it should be. And I hope that it does expand to the point where people think about prevention more than just what happens when you actually have it. But that reminds me, I think I saw in New York or in Washington, they actually have ambulances with CT machines on them now. So maybe that might be the future. Might be one day have a Trinidad.
CT ambulance is the way forward. It's just they are very expensive resource. But what you can do is that people are using AI kind of modules to determine when a patient has a CT scan, whether you give them the clot busting medication or not, based on millions of CT scans of this particular patient population. And it's the medicine itself is going to evolve very, very rapidly in the next couple of years. And physicians need to be abreast of it, otherwise
definitely
left behind.
Definitely. I think we need to use it, we need to adopt it. So we just have a few minutes left, Dr. Maharaj, and the conversation is going so good. And I think people, all listeners or viewers, have gotten so much out from this, but I just want you to give your closing thoughts and maybe leave your closing words of advice for persons, maybe on prevention or maybe some advice to someone out there who has had a stroke and maybe feeling hopeless. What do you tell them?
Stroke is serious, right? But it's very largely preventable. Know the signs, be fast, balance, eyes, facial weakness, arm weakness, speaking difficulty, time to get yourself to the emergency department. Act quickly because time is brain, as quickly as possible, and take care of your overall health. Control your pressure, your sugar, your cholesterol. Don't smoke. If you never smoked before, don't start. If you have sleep apnea, fix that. Keep your overall health good. Keep very low your alcohol consumption. If you or a loved one get symptoms of a stroke, do hesitate. Get to a hospital as soon as possible. I can do a CT scan. Many people get these symptoms and say, "All right, cool. I'm going to take a little rest. I'm going to take a little sleep. And I'll go get back up and I'll get back better." And boom, they wake up and paralyzed. One half of the body. Misty window. For those who had stroke before, recovery is possible because you still recover weeks, months, to even years after you've had the initial stroke with the right amount of physiotherapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy. And with that care and that support, people could, in a very large extent, regain their independence. They could thrive. So they need to be aware, and awareness is your best defense against these things. And yeah, that's pretty much it. That's my pitch.
And thanks for that. And I mean, as I said, we have a lot more to discuss and some other topics around neurology we could chat about. Last time we chatted about diabetic neuropathy. And so there are other topics we want to touch on. And we'll have Dr. Miraj on the program again very soon. And I want to thank our listeners for participating and for tuning in. We'll be on again next week at 12 noon on Freedom. For diabetes and you again. If you do need assistance from the Diabetes Association, give us a call at 607-3288 or send us a message on any of the social media platforms or visit us at our head office in Chaguanas. We're on Success Street in Chaguanas. So thanks again and thanks, Tusker, for facilitating today's program.
No
And
problem.
hope he is enjoying himself wherever he is the rest of your day.
Thanks so much.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.